well-wishing others. B. To myself. Determine what I want. Life, art, seek help. Never deceive myself. Look for the wonder and beauty. C. To my family. Cherish them. They look to me for love, guidance. D. To my work. Above all, seek balance. Personal acclaim is the alcoholic's poison. E. To AA. To God and AA, I owe my deliverance. At the bottom of the list, he wrote instructions to himself. Be careful how you live. You may be the only copy of the big book other people ever read. When Berryman started to consider writing a novel about recovery, he imagined a book that would function not as great literature, but as a 12th step. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics, bringing recovery to those who hadn't found it yet. He scribbled ideas for what this book might become. Make a book of these notes. Useful 12th step work. Probably hardly worked up at all, only expanded and glossed with some background on Hazelden and St. Mary's last spring. This wasn't another lyric dream song. It was something else. Hardly worked up at all. Not meant to be beautiful, but useful. In considering his book, Useful 12th Step Work, Berryman was following the desire he'd articulated on his inventories, to replace the ambition to be a great poet with a creative life committed to love for others. He thought of calling the novel Korsakoff's Syndrome on the Grave, but found he preferred I Am an Alcoholic. Like better, he wrote next to this simpler title. Eventually, he just called the book Recovery. He wanted to donate the profits, give half my royalties to who? Not AA. They won't take it. Perhaps just lend it privately to AAs in despair. Berryman kept his notes in a beige notebook labeled Recovery Notebook, stained with coffee. His life no longer ran on whiskey and ink, but on caffeine and graphite, less godly fuels. He wanted recovery to constitute an act of gratitude. In an early draft, he imagined his dedication. This summary and diluted account of the beginning of my recovery is devoted to the men and women responsible for it. The founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, physicians, psychiatrists, counselors, clergymen, psychologists, transactional analysts, group leaders, nurses, orderlies, inpatients, outpatients, members of AA, and to its primary divine author. In the spring of 1971, less than a year before his death, Berryman taught a course at the University of Minnesota called The Post-Novel, Fiction as Wisdom Work. This was what he was attempting in recovery as well, something like wisdom work. Though Jean Rhys was never in recovery, she once wrote an imagined courtroom scene called The Trial of Jean Rhys, scribbled in spidery script in a plain brown notebook that looks remarkably like the fearless moral inventory of an AA fourth step. After the prosecution lists the major themes of her work, good, evil, love, hate, life, death, beauty, ugliness, and asks Rhys if they apply to everyone, she replies, I do not know everyone. I only know myself. When the prosecution persists, and others, she confesses, I do not know others. I see them as trees walking. That's when the prosecution pounces. There you are. Didn't take long, did it? Part of Rhys's torment was that her self-absorption wasn't complete enough to make her unaware of its effect on others. But in the trial, confessing her solipsism doesn't count as repentance. It just confirms her guilt. The prosecution continues its line of questioning. Did you, in your youth, have a great love and pity for others, especially for the poor and unfortunate? Yes. Were you able to show this? I think I could not always. I was very clumsy. No one told me. Excuse, of course, prosecution shouts. It is untrue that you are cold and withdrawn. It is not true. Did you make great efforts to, shall we say, establish contacts with other people? I mean, friendships, love affairs, so on? Yes. Not friendships very much. Did you succeed? Sometimes. For a time. It didn't last. No. Whose fault was that? Mine, I suppose. You suppose? Silence. Better answer. I am tired. I learned everything too late. Reese's trial echoes Berryman's inventories. What bothers me most about myself at the present time? Poverty of love for others. Even when Reese articulates some faith in human possibility, I believe that sometimes human beings can be more than themselves. The prosecution still objects. Come, come. This is very bad. Can't you do better than that? After that exchange, the trial transcript just reads, silence. Objection sustained. But Reese did believe there was a way she could surrender herself to something larger than her claustrophobic sadness. If I stop writing, she told the court, my life will have been an abject failure. I will not have earned death. The fantasy that brilliant writing might redeem a flawed life. If I can do this book, it won't matter so much, will it? Didn't belong solely to Reese. When Carver was brought to court in 1976, accused of collecting unemployment while he was employed, his first wife, Marianne, showed the court his first collection of stories as a defense on his behalf, presenting the brilliance of his work as an excuse for the disappointments and deceptions of his life. Perhaps it's not enough. For the critic A. Alvarez, Reese's monstrous life made a powerful argument against biography itself. The effect of Reese's first published biography was to make the reader doubt if any book, however original, however perfect, could be worth the price Reese and those close to her paid. Neither of Reese's biographies made me want to spend a long weekend with her, but I'm not interested in the question of whether her work is worth the price, to us or to anyone, because it was never our choice to make. Her life was. The work is. We can't trade either back. There's no objective metric for how much brilliance might be required to redeem a lifetime of damage, and no ratio that justifies the conversion. Whatever beauty comes from pain can't usually be traded back for happiness. Reese kept hoping anyway, not for relief, but for the possibility of an assuaging beauty, that by voicing her thirst well enough, she could redeem the damage it had caused. When Berryman scrawled down a daily plan for writing recovery, he was also outlining the healthier life he imagined the novel ushering him into. Write 8 or 9 to 1 p.m. in study. Aim at 2 pages a day with next sentences drafted. Walk. Drive. Library. Immunology. Alcoholism. Journals. Exercise and yoga. 24-hour book. AA Lit. 1 or 2 short biographies, especially famous alcoholics. Poe. Hart Crane. His notes betray a tone of self-exhortation. Walk. Drive. And willed excitement. Journals. He wanted to do his homework. He wanted to do yoga. He wanted to ground himself in a tradition of other drunk writers. Poe. His exclamation points hold a certain heartbreak. Walk. Drive. He wanted to believe in rituals and intention. He wanted to believe in showing up for a life you'd chosen. In his novel Kentucky Ham, Billy Burroughs Jr. wrote about working on a fishing trawler after his time at the narco farm. We worked like I never did at Lexington, he wrote, and he liked it. For him, work was the opposite of addiction. You know what work does? It provides a constant. It structures time. I realize that a fix has to get done also, and no two ways about it, but a fix goes in. To fix. To adjust. To focus. But what I'm talking about goes out, and in a choosy way, rearranges reality. For me, too, the drinking was always about taking something in, drinking something down, solace from the outside that could, for a time, be misunderstood as strength. And if the drinking had gone in, the work went out, just as Burroughs had said. As I got drunk and got sober, I liked that my bakery shifts stayed constant. It was always the same drill. Show up at 7. Work my production list. It was always pick up the pace on those squirrels. The routine of the bakery worked like another ritual, like the comforting structure of meetings. Another shape I didn't have to invent. A way of being useful. We marked the seasons with hundreds of cookies each week. Frogs with tiny love letters for Valentine's Day, ice cream cones for summer, and glittery swirled leaves for autumn. Snowmen in December with tiny orange triangles for noses. It was ridiculous, maybe, but they gave me a way to say, I did that. Brought some small, undeniable pleasure to another person. The camaraderie of the kitchen was surprising and often humbling. One of our bakers made a lightsaber from frozen cinnamon buns and ate green bell peppers for lunch, cradling each one in his palm, whole and crunchy like an apple. Another one liked to tease me about my general ineptness, so on his days off, just to irritate him, I texted him photos of the donuts I'd made in our miniature deep fry, which looked like giant mutant shrimps, captioned, quality control. For a Planned Parenthood fundraiser, I made a cake with 30 circular cookies stuck around the top like birth control pills. I was trying to adjust. To focus. That first winter of my second sobriety, I got my first down jacket. For years I'd felt personally persecuted by winter, a martyr to its bitter chill, my numbness epic and inevitable, the air little more than an external companion to my interior weather. But as it turned out, wearing a good jacket made you less cold. For Valentine's Day, Dave and I drove north to Dubuque, an old river money town perched on bluffs over the Mississippi. We played roulette at the riverboat casino and marveled at an octopus at the aquarium, swirling its legs like scarves in the water, purple and pearl white, its suckers making little moons wherever it squished them against the glass. Dave was someone who could get excited about an octopus or a dilapidated boomtown, and the fact that he could bring out that sense of wonder in me made me want to give it back to him. That was part of why I'd planned the weekend in Dubuque, though it was bittersweet, everything delicate. We were careful with each other. Not long before the trip, while I was cleaning our apartment, I'd found a messy pile of notes stacked on Dave's dresser, all the apologies I'd written, all the mornings after we'd fought, each one acknowledging how many had come before it. A few days later, I'd asked if he was interested in coming to a meeting, something I hadn't done the first time around. I wanted to invite him into this new version of my life, rather than blaming him for not already being in it with me. When he came, he was eloquent and thoughtful, moved by the things other people said. Three elderly women came up to me afterward and said, "He's so charming." It was like the time we'd gone to see a couples therapist, a middle-aged woman who ran sessions from her house in the suburbs and leaned over when Dave went to the bathroom. Well, he's certainly charming. My face must have looked shocked because she quickly said, "But I can imagine he's a real Jekyll and Hyde." In Dubuque, we went to a Bavarian pub for dinner and ordered head cheese and goulash. There were approximately 300,000 beers on tap. I was desperately determined to enjoy the head cheese. Maybe I wasn't drinking beer, but I was trying something new. At a certain point, the bar broke into song. Strangers belted out drinking anthems in German, though the message was clear enough across the language gap. Drinking is awesome, and more drinking is more awesome, and most drinking is most. The head cheese was disgusting. Dave and I went back to our bed and breakfast full of decorative plates and watched Dune on VHS, watched the fat man fly around with his little jets, deformed and degraded by the spice, his drug, totally slave to it. We curled up under our quilt, and I thought, maybe this can be saved. 10. Humbling. Everyone shared at meetings, but telling your story meant speaking in a more structured way. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now. Usually at the beginning of the meeting, for anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes. People had different philosophies about how to approach it. I'm not going to give you my drunkalogue, because all our drunkalogues are the same, some people said, and launched straight into sobriety. But I love drunkalogues. I couldn't get enough of them. They were like getting dessert before dinner. Sure, they were all the same, but they were all different, too, insofar as every particular life manifested and disrupted the common themes in its own way. Drunkalogues were also useful because they reminded me of certain absences it was easy to take for granted after they'd been absent for a while. Not waking up early with a hangover, or not thinking about booze every minute, every hour, every day. A type of progress that depended on not being aware of it. The first time I spoke, the time I got heckled by an old-timer, this is boring. It was in the basement of a school, a gym with gleaming hardwood floors and bleachers pushed into the walls, and a wooden stage where we laid out grocery store cookies in their plastic trays next to a tarnished silver coffee maker. For the Monday speaker meeting, the folding chairs were laid out in rows, probably 40 of them, with an aisle down the center, like a literary reading or a wedding. The night I had agreed to speak, I wore a shiny black shirt that wouldn't show the sweat under my armpits. 15 minutes before the meeting began, there were only a scattering of people, mostly people I knew, friendly faces, the therapist who was in the midst of a divorce, the man whose infant daughter had died 6 years earlier. But the crowd was sparse, and I began to worry it was because word had gotten out that I was speaking. This was typical thinking, imagining the world as a conspiracy of forces directing their attention toward me, when it was more likely people were just picking up their dry cleaning or watching the Bachelor episode they'd been looking forward to all week. When more people started arriving, I realized I'd also been relieved at the low turnout and immediately started to imagine how everyone who'd shown up might be disappointed by what I said. Before the meeting began, I poured a scalding cup of coffee and grabbed a brittle chocolate chip cookie, took one bite and then put it down in front of me, on the folding table I sat behind, facing the crowd, beside the meeting's chairperson, a woman I trusted. She had short-cropped gray hair and a teenage daughter, and she spoke with matter-of-fact warmth. She was honest about her mistakes, but not exhausting in her regret. My half-eaten cookie stared up at me as I told my story, which ended up focusing less on narrative drama and more on things I was surprised to find myself talking about. Waking in the middle of the night worried about my meds, with a racing heart like a bird trapped in the cage of my ribs, and finding that stack of apologies on Dave's dresser. It was right about then, just when I'd started to feel pretty righteous about moving away from narrative interest and toward emotional candor, that the man in the wheelchair started shouting, "This is boring." After he started shouting, I started unraveling. Heat in my eyes, swell in my throat, voice starting to crack open, and struggled to finish the thought I was articulating about prayer. "It's like picking up a heavy box," I said. "I mean, prayer is like putting down the heavy box, but then I kept trying to pick it up again." I started crying fully. Again, the man yelled, "This is boring." He wasn't a bad person. He was just losing his grip on whatever part of us keeps us from shouting at strangers. And maybe, also, he was bored. I wiped my eyes with the back of my hand. What was my other thing I had to say about prayer? I had another thing to say about prayer. Multiple women in the audience reached for tissues in their purses. After the meeting, one of them came up to me immediately. "It was so moving to see you cry," she said, "when you started talking about prayer." Then another woman, the chair of the meeting, put her hand on my arm and said, "You just told my story. Thank you." Malcolm Lowry's greatest nightmare was being accused of telling someone else's story. That's why he was so outraged by the success of Jackson's Lost Weekend, and by its publication in the first place. by the idea that someone else had told his story before he'd been able to tell it. Years later, in his unfinished final novel, Dark as the Grave Wherein My Friend Is Laid, Lowry offered a thinly fictionalized account of his own anger, a scene in which a novelist named Sigbjorn Wilderness discovers that his alcoholic magnum opus has been scooped by a terrible book called Drunkard's Rigadoon. It's purely a clinical study, Sigbjorn's wife assures him. It's only a small part of yours. But Sigbjorn is crushed. If his alcoholism hasn't helped him produce an original masterpiece, what good has it been? He was sure he'd been achieving something that was unique, but instead is told by his agent and several publishers that his book is merely a copy. When a dismissive 1947 review in Harper's Magazine accused Under the Volcano of being a long regurgitation that can only be recommended as an anthology held together by earnestness, little more than a patchwork imitating the tricks of better authors, Lowry defended himself in a passionate letter to the editor. Though critic Jacques Barzun had given the novel only a paragraph in his review, saying its characters were desperately dull even when sober, this is boring, Lowry's rebuttal was 22 indignant paragraphs long. It closed with a postscript suggesting which line Lowry truly couldn't forgive. P.S. Anthology held together by earnestness. Brr. It's as if the charge of redundancy was so grave that it had banished Lowry to the cold, a merciless literary exile. But an anthology held together by earnestness? It's one of the most apt descriptions of a recovery meeting, its particular beauty, that I've ever heard. More than 30 years after he wrote The Shining, and 20 years after he got sober, Stephen King started to wonder whether a more fulfilling sobriety might have been possible for Jack Torrance, the dry drunk writer who blew up the Overlook Hotel. What would have happened to Danny's troubled father, King asked himself, if he had found Alcoholics Anonymous? King's 2013 novel, Dr. Sleep, was an attempt to answer this question. The plot follows Jack's son, Danny, now grown up into a drunk like his dad, but finally clean and sober, as he fights an anonymous collective called the True Knot, a band of RV-dwelling supernatural monsters who chant in circles before they drink pain harvested from their unfortunate victims. The True Knot looks like a sinister version of AA, a fellowship of suffering where pain has become, quite literally, a form of sustenance. The novel's climax, however, is not Danny's triumph over the True Knot, but a scene directly afterward, when Danny finally confesses his true bottom to an AA group at his 15th sobriety anniversary. He describes the morning he woke up in bed with a coked-up single mom and stole money from her wallet while her diapered son reached for a pile of leftover Coke on the coffee table, thinking it was candy. Leftover Coke? The addict in me was dismayed, but the shame was familiar. After Danny confesses his terrible truth, the moment of honesty that the whole book has been building toward, he gets very little in response. The women in the doorway had gone back to the kitchen. Some of the people were looking at their watches. A stomach grumbled. Looking at the assembled 9 dozen alkies, Dan realized an astounding thing. What he'd done didn't revolt them. It didn't even surprise them. They had heard worse. The narrative doesn't just insist on the moment as anticlimactic. It insists that this anticlimax has still been meaningful. As it turned out, my own sobriety held the same double moral as a second act Stephen King novel. You've spoken your truth, and now everyone is making a beeline for your sober birthday cake. Your story is probably pretty ordinary. This doesn't mean it can't be useful. When I finally read the manuscript of Charles Jackson's unfinished novel, What Happened, the pages he had written under the influence of recovery, unpublished in his archives, I brought so much desire with me. It was like the desire poet Yvonne Bolin confesses when she asks for poems with women in them who aren't beautiful or young. I want a poem I can grow old in. I want a poem I can die in. I wanted a story I could get sober in. This made it disappointing to confront the manuscript of What Happened, which offered a tedious, convoluted narrative I found difficult to keep reading. I can only write the human, meanderingly, Jackson had written to a friend, confessing his fears about his long-awaited epic, and I started to understand what he'd meant. I'd been glued to The Lost Weekend, unable to put it down, and I wanted What Happened to be like that, only better, about functionality. But it wasn't. Mostly, it was hopelessly abstract. What life means, it came to him, or he seemed to overhear it. It means all the time, not just at isolated dramatic moments that never happened. If life means anything at all, it means whatever it means every hour, every minute, through any episode big or small, if only one has the awareness to sense it. Each step, the dramatic and the humdrum alike, every fleeting second of the way. The thing was, I actually agreed with what Jackson was saying. I'd come to believe that life happened every hour, every minute, that it wasn't made of dramatic climaxes so much as quiet effort and continuous presence. But I could also see how Jackson's desperate desire to deploy his recovery wisdom had crippled his story. His own words about the book now played back to me like an omen. With scarcely any plot, but much character, I'm proud to be so objective and detached. Finally. The manuscript bore out some of my worst fears about sobriety, that it was destined to force you into a state of plotless abstraction, a string of empty evenings, a life lit by the sallow fluorescence of church basement bromides rather than the glow of dive bar neon signs. The reckless readability of The Lost Weekend, the momentum of Don's escapades, and the roaring engine of his thirst had been replaced by stasis. If Jackson was afraid he would only ever be known for The Lost Weekend, then Lowry carried a similar fear that he would never write anything as good as Under the Volcano. Even his fears were unoriginal. But after several rounds of brutal aversion therapy to treat his alcoholism in the mid-1950s, Lowry embarked on a major round of edits on the book he hoped might someday surpass his alcoholic magnum opus. October Ferry to Gabriola was a novel about the happiest years of his marriage, spent in a squatter's shack north of Vancouver. In critic D.T. Max's account, Lowry wrote furiously in the aftermath of his aversion therapy, new pages that examined what he called the alcoholicost of his life, and the way that drinking had affected his art. Lowry took apology letters he'd written to his wife, Marjorie, over the years, and pasted them directly into the draft. He was trying to fill the book with the texture of his regret, to make it not just a transcript of harm, but also the process of reckoning. This kind of salvage made me imagine crafting a book from my own apology notes. The response from others was a bit less enthusiastic. Lowry's editor at Random House canceled his contract for the book because the manuscript sent to him was just about as tedious as anything I'd ever read. After Lowry's death, Marjorie added her own comments to the manuscript. Rambling notes, she wrote. Seems like a dissertation on alcohol. Nothing useful here. When I read the manuscript of Jackson's What Happened, I grasped at its meager glimmers of plot. He had the impulse to pull the car over to the side of the road and give himself up to introspection, a kind of self-inventory, leaving nothing out. Okay, he's in a car, I thought, but where was he going? Would something finally happen there? I perked up at the mention of an inventory, like the AA fourth step, because maybe that meant I would get to read about how Don had fucked up. But then I felt guilty for wanting the train wreck. I was supposed to be rooting for the underdog story, the story of sobriety, but instead my own lapsed attention was just proof that this story would never be as interesting as the story of getting drunk. It was like sitting in a meeting and hoping the drunkalogue would never stop, thinking, yeah, 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 at the part about a newfound connection to a higher power. I didn't want to think, yeah, 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 about sobriety. Didn't want my eyes glazing over at its even-keeled horizon line. I was afraid that loving the drunk story best meant some part of me still wanted to keep living it. And of course, some part of me did. During those first few months after I quit drinking the second time, sobriety often felt like gripping onto monkey bars with sweaty metallic palms, just praying I didn't fall. When an arts cooperative in a small Iowa farm town offered me a week in their workshop, a converted tofu factory in the middle of soybean fields, offered as barter payment for judging a student contest, I spent my days trying not to think about the kitchen counter in the nearby farmhouse where I was staying and the bottles of red wine someone had left there. I asked Dave if he wanted to drive over from Iowa City and stay with me, share the tofu factory, but he said he was behind on a deadline. He was often behind on a deadline and needed to stay at home. Once he said he wasn't coming, it became even harder to stop fantasizing about drinking. It would be so easy to get drunk out in these ghostly soybean fields, all alone, to sink into that blooming warmth and not tell anyone. So I tried to distract myself. Because I was afraid to go back to my farmhouse at night, to those three bottles I could picture so clearly, I stayed up till 3 in the morning trying to work in the converted tofu factory. It was barely converted to anything, still full of broken machinery, tackle boxes, and rusty metal lockers, with loose screws rolling down the concrete loading dock. The worst night, I sat at my big slab of a desk until 5 in the morning and watched a BBC miniseries about just industrialized 19th century Manchester, snow falling on mill strikes, and then started rewatching it, and then watched the making of special about it, all so I wouldn't have to go back to the farmhouse and reckon with those bottles of wine. The next morning, I looked online for a list of meetings in town. At noon, I showed up at the address I'd found, a brick church with a stained glass window that looked dull in the sunlight. The front door was locked, but when I circled around to the back, where two bikers in full leather were standing with a white-haired woman in a mint-green pantsuit, I knew I'd come to the right place. It was just the four of us, until a woman in sweatpants showed up. A single mother who lived on a farm nearby with her son. It was only her second meeting, she said. One of the bikers, smiling, said, "The journey begins." "I hope so," she said. "I can't even imagine tomorrow." It turned out the back door was locked and the person with the key hadn't come, so I thought maybe we'd all go our separate ways. But no, we all went to a gazebo in the park instead, and sat in the dappled sunshine on splintered wooden benches. The woman in the pantsuit was a local librarian, and the bikers were just passing through. The single mother was 10 days sober and totally falling apart. Her son had seen her crying 2 days in a row. Their llama was going through puberty and acting like a little shit. When it was my turn to speak, I told everyone about rewatching the BBC miniseries just to keep myself from drinking, and one of the bikers, a huge man with a snake tattooed around his neck, nodded so vigorously I was sure he'd say he'd seen that miniseries too. He hadn't, but he knew what it was like when craving tugged you like a puppet. He told us about his first drink, and when he paused to describe the smell of that bourbon, he spoke straight to my gut, straight to those terrifying bottles in the farmhouse pantry. It wasn't his words so much as his pause, how it held him for a moment, the memory of that bourbon smell, how it stopped him in his speech. A few days later, I met the single mother for coffee. She brought me bratwurst made from her goats, and I told her I didn't know what it was like to be a single mother, or any kind of mother, but I did know about crying every day, and I also knew that the 90th day of my sobriety had been pretty different from the 10th one. The second time I got sober, I started praying with a sense of purpose. It was impossible to picture the clear outline of any God, but praying regularly was a way to separate my second sobriety from my first one. Back then, I'd only prayed haphazardly, when I wanted something, basically. This time around, I understood arranging my body into a certain position twice a day as a way to articulate commitment rather than a bodily lie, a false pretense. I prayed in the bathroom, by the toilet, under the dirty skylight over our shower, where Dave wouldn't see me. He wasn't judgmental. I was just embarrassed. It was easier to be alone with my fumbling faith, and it felt good to kneel on the bathroom floor for different reasons than I'd knelt on it before. Not throwing up or getting ready to throw up, but closing my eyes and asking to be useful. I'd been told to pray for people I resented, so I prayed for Dave and for every girl he'd ever flirted with, for every man I'd ever hated for not wanting me. I even liked the physical residue of these morning prayers, the tangled red pattern on my knees from the bath mat we didn't clean enough. When I was younger, I'd gone, reluctantly, to a regal Episcopal church in Inglewood. My mother had started going to church after she and my father divorced, and she'd asked me to come with her. The church was stunning, with massive copper lanterns hanging from the wooden beams and jeweled light stilled by the stained glass windows on Sunday mornings, angels with red-tipped fiery wings. The golden altar held a pale statue of Jesus with a sculpted triangular beard and ruthlessly serene eyes. His finger raised, as if he were just about to say something. But what? Going to church meant feeling something just out of reach, a sense of connection to this pale man, or the sermon, or the songs, the ecstatic faith that seemed to swell inside everyone else. I wasn't sure I believed in God, so wouldn't it be lying if I prayed to him? The premise of the miracle at the heart of everything, that impossible resurrection, made me feel miserly with disbelief, like my heart was a locked storefront shuttered against sublimity. I was shy and uncomfortable in my own body, kneecaps bruised by wooden kneelers, afraid of the vulnerabilities of belief, afraid to find anything too beautiful or fall for it. Because I wasn't baptized, I couldn't take communion, so I either sat alone in my pew while everyone else walked up to the altar, or else I went forward and knelt on the velvet cushion, arms crossed over my chest, while the priest placed his palm on my head and said, "I bless you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit." But I didn't believe in any of them, and it seemed dishonest to take a blessing in their name. The more you had to make yourself believe, I was sure, the more false your belief was. Years later, recovery turned this notion upside down. It made me start to believe that I could do things until I believed in them, that intentionality was just as authentic as unwilled desire. Action could coax belief rather than testifying to it. "I used to think you had to believe to pray," David Foster Wallace once heard at a meeting. "Now I know I had it ass backwards." For a long time, I'd believed that sincerity was all about actions lining up with belief, knowing myself and acting accordingly. But when it came to drinking, I'd parsed my motivations in 1,000 sincere conversations. With friends, with therapists, with my mother, with my boyfriends, and all my self-understanding hadn't granted me any release from compulsion. This ruptured syllogism, "If I understand myself, I'll get better," made me question the way I'd come to worship self-awareness itself, a brand of secular humanism, know thyself and act accordingly. What if you reversed this? Act and know thyself differently. Showing up for a meeting, for a ritual, for a conversation, this was an act that could be true no matter what you felt as you were doing it. Doing something without knowing if you believed it, that was proof of sincerity, rather than its absence. I didn't know what I believed, and prayed anyway. I called my sponsor even when I didn't want to, showed up to meetings even when I didn't want to. I sat in the circle and held hands with everyone, opened myself to cliches I felt ashamed to be described by, got down on my knees to pray even though I wasn't sure what I was praying to, only what I was praying for. Don't drink, don't drink, don't drink. The desire to believe that there was something out there, something that wasn't me, that could make not drinking seem like anything other than punishment. This desire was strong enough to dissolve the rigid border I'd drawn between faith and its absence. When I looked back on my early days in church, I started to realize how silly it had been to think that I'd had a monopoly on doubt, or that wanting faith was so categorically different from having it. When people in the program talked about a higher power, they sometimes simply said HP, which seemed expansive and open, a pair of letters you could fill with whatever you needed. The sky, other people in meetings, an old woman who wore loose flowing skirts like my grandmother had worn. Whatever it was, I needed to believe in something stronger than my willpower. This willpower was a fine-tuned machine, fierce and humming, and it had done plenty of things. Gotten me straight A's, gotten my papers written, gotten me through cross-country training runs. But when I'd applied it to drinking, the only thing I felt was that I was turning my life into a small, joyless, clenched fist. The higher power that turned sobriety into more than deprivation was simply not me. That was all I knew. It was a force animating the world in all of its particular glories. Jellyfish, the clean turn of line breaks, pineapple upside down cake, my friend Rachel's laughter. Perhaps I'd been looking for it, for whatever it was, for years, bent over the toilet on all those other nights, retching and heaving. When Charles Jackson reread The Lost Weekend, years into his inconstant sobriety, he was most of all impressed by the sense that, in spite of the hero's utter self-absorption, it is a picture of a man groping for God, or at least trying to find out who he is. He understood the old patterns as driven by the same hungers, the hunger for booze as the hunger for God, all this groping as part of the same journey. At times, it seemed my relationship wasn't to a higher power but to the act of prayer itself, a ritualized cry of longing and insufficiency, as if my faith were a catalog of places I'd gotten on my knees, 100 bathrooms where I'd knelt on cold tiles with thin ribbons of grout under my shins, or crouched on a foot-worn bath mat facing the eye-level skyline of my mother's bubble bath, jars of pearly peach and vanilla. In those bathrooms, God wasn't faceless omnipotence, but proximate particulars, grout and soap, the things that had always been there, right in front of me. During the spring of my first sobriety, I had embarked on a different type of writing project than I'd ever pursued before. I drove to the Tennessee wilderness to write about an ultramarathon my brother was running, a 125-mile race through briar-cloaked hills and hollers around the outskirts of a deserted federal penitentiary. The runners spent days in the woods, circling back to a central campsite after every loop to fill their fanny packs with candy bars and pop their blisters with sewing needles. I'd never done anything like this, conducting interviews and gleaning observations to write about the lives of strangers, and the sheer plenitude thrilled me. How much was all around me, just waiting to be gathered. I slept in my car and filled a notebook with details. One runner's tale of seeing a wild boar on the trail, the dead-tired glass of his eyes and the mud on his legs, rain pattering on the roof of my Toyota all night, sliced by the lonely cry of bugle taps played whenever a runner dropped out of the race. I ate chicken slathered in barbecue sauce, roasted over a campfire in the smoke and chill of early spring, and asked these runners why they pushed themselves past the limits of what they thought they could endure. What community was made possible by a shared confrontation with pain? Even this attempt at reportage was turning into autobiography, but it was still something new, inspiring and awkward. Before interviews, I got nervous, my armpits dampened with sweat, my pulse spiked up. I was a terrible interviewer at first, too eager to prove myself and so busy saying, "Yeah, I know exactly what you mean," that I never gave people enough room to speak. Often I stuttered when I asked my questions and cringed whenever someone shrugged or squinted in reply. But it surprised me, my own ability to make eye contact. Meetings had trained me. whenever someone shared, you had to look at her, so that if she ever locked eyes with you, you could give what she was saying a place to land. By the time Berryman started working on his novel Recovery, he had come to see the notion that he needed to drink in order to write as a delusion. So long as I considered myself as merely the medium, arena for my powers, sobriety was out of the question, he wrote in 1971 in a handwritten note he later adapted for use in the novel. The even deeper delusion that my art depended on my drinking, or at least was connected with it, could not be attacked directly. Too far down. The cover had to be exploded off. Several years earlier, in a 1965 review in the New York Times, Charles Jackson had questioned the mythic figure of the tormented artist. Are we really all that tormented? Or is it something we hang on to, foster, even cherish, till it becomes an end in itself, full of self-defeating interest? In this review of Lowry's selected letters, a review that would have infuriated Lowry if he'd been alive to read it, Jackson wondered what Lowry might have been able to write if by some supreme effort, some mystical or psychological shifting of gears, the tormented man had been able to get on another level and get outside of himself. Jackson was probably thinking more specifically about recovery, something he wasn't willing to name explicitly. Perhaps thinking about what he'd told an AA meeting 6 years earlier, I couldn't get outside myself, or his own unfinished novel, his attempt to get, for the first time, out of myself. Marguerite Duras certainly wrote drunk, but she didn't harbor any delusions about what the drinking did for her work. Instead of drinking coffee when I woke up, she wrote, I started straight away on whiskey or wine. I was often sick after the wine, the pituitary vomiting typical of alcoholics. I'd vomit the wine I'd just drunk and start drinking some more right away. Usually the vomiting stopped after the second try, and I'd be glad. Her pragmatic approach to this particular oblivion, the typical and totally unsingular vomiting, the relief when her body stopped resisting the booze, dismissed myths and opted for something more matter-of-fact. Drunkenness doesn't create anything. The illusion's perfect. You're sure what you're saying has never been said before. But alcohol can't produce anything that lasts. It's just wind. Duras's critique of the illusion of drunken creativity is also a critique of the illusion of singularity, the idea that what you're saying has never been said before, one of the precise notions that recovery pushes against. In my own sobriety, I'd given up on that impossible ideal of saying what had never been said, but I also believed every unoriginal idea could be reborn in the particularity of any given life. As my sobriety continued, my writing turned toward interviews and journeys, asking a long-distance runner in a West Virginia prison what it felt like to be trapped in one place, asking a woman at a Harlem community center about the way her obsession with a mysterious whale helped her recover from a 7-week coma. Duras herself was never involved in any organized recovery, though she did undergo 3 brutal disintoxication treatments at the American Hospital of Paris. Their physical toll nearly killed her and brought on terrible delusions, a woman's head shattering like it was made of glass, or exactly 10,000 tortoises arranging themselves into formations on a nearby roof. Duras even dreamed a vision of the communal salve she never actually experienced. The sound of singing, solo and in chorus, would rise up from the inner courtyard under my windows, and when I looked out, I would see crowds of people who I was sure had come to save me from death. After one of his admissions into detox, Berryman wrote a poem addressed to his fellow patients, Tyson and Joe. Take up, outside your blocked selves, some small thing that is moving and wants to keep on moving and needs, therefore, Tyson, Joe, your loving. The poet teaches what he most needs to learn, and Berryman was constantly finding ways to recommit himself to the lives of others. In the margins of a grapevine, an AA magazine, next to one prompt. Have I a personal responsibility in helping an AA group fulfill its primary purpose? What is my part? Berryman wrote, to listen. Next to, what is the real importance of me among 500,000 AAs? He wrote, 1/500,000th. There were 500,000 AAs for Berryman to love, every one of them moving. Recovery was about understanding himself as one tiny numerator, a blocked self above the larger denominator of a community, many communities. As part of his step work, Berryman listed all the groups he was part of. My groups, K and Twist, AA, Friends and Poets, Cal, etc. Common Cause, Hum, All of M, Shakespeareans, Students, The Church, America, The Human Race. K and Twist were his wife, Kate, and their daughter, Martha. Cal was Robert Lowell. Hum was his division, Humanities, at the University of Minnesota. Common Cause meant protesting the war in Vietnam. He wanted to love his colleagues and his school. He wanted to love strangers halfway around the world, strangers his country was bombing in the name of its democratic vision. Hence, America, in scare quotes. Hence, the human race. AA was the group that asked him to face his responsibilities to all the other groups on the list. Writing his novel was not only an opportunity to offer something to these communities, useful 12-step work, but also a way to dramatize the difficulty of becoming part of one, the struggle to humble himself, to submerge his own voice by making himself 1/500,000th of the chorus rather than its soloist. The protagonist of Recovery is a renowned former professor of immunology named Alan Severance, almost amusingly revered, as if celebrity immunologists are nothing out of the ordinary, who struggles, as Berryman did, to reconcile his acclaimed professional life with his identity as a debilitated alcoholic. From his room at rehab, Severance sees the spires of the college campus where he teaches. Towers above the trees across the river reminded him that he was University Professor Severance, not the craven drunk Alan S., who had been told by an orderly that his room smelled like a farmyard. At rehab, Severance is constantly reaching for the part of himself capable of something besides self-concern. His own hope was to forget about himself and think about the others. These are the same instructions that Berryman gives Tyson and Joe. Take up, outside your blocked selves, some small thing. Who can Severance take up? There's a man named George, who is still seeking the approval of his dead father, or a woman named Sherry, who isn't interested in anything, until, to Severance's great delight, she gets interested in the history of North Dakota. There's another woman, named Mirabella, who tells the group that she hasn't wanted to do anything but scream for years. You don't remember a time when you didn't have it? Her counselor asks, and she replies, drinking sends it away. The core question of recovery is whether something else might send it away instead. Perhaps other people might. In hospitals, he found his society, Berryman's friend Saul Bellow wrote about his stints in rehab. About these passioning countrymen, he did not need to be ironical. When George finally accepts that his dead father had good reason to be proud of him, Severance is so moved, he finds himself fighting sobs. And when George climbs onto a chair to announce his joy, I did it! I did it! Severance catches his exuberance as contagion. Cheers from everybody, general exultation, universal relief and joy. Severance felt triumphant. But recovery is also canny about the ways that resonance can become self-involvement, an absorption in the strength of your own emotional response. When George is having his breakthrough, it's actually difficult for Severance to hear him because his own empathy gets so loud. There was more, but Severance was fighting sobs and didn't hear it. When the group recites the Serenity Prayer, Severance hates that his rich, practiced lecturer's voice had dominated the chorus, giving him no pleasure. Even when he forces himself to say the same words as everyone else, he still yearns to be loudest. One woman who had been at rehab with Berryman remembered that he couldn't ever be wholehearted about belonging with the rest of us. He was constantly retreating into his uniqueness, she said. He really thought it was all he had that made him worth anything. Googling the phrase, just another addiction memoir, yields several pages of results, mostly blurbs insisting that a certain book isn't just another addiction memoir, an author insisting his book isn't just another addiction memoir, or an editor insisting she didn't acquire just another addiction memoir. This insistent chorus reflects a broader disdain for the already told story and a cynical take on interchangeability. The idea that if we've heard this story before, we won't want to hear it again. But the accusation of sameness, just another addiction memoir, gets turned on its head by recovery, where a story's sameness is precisely why it should be told. Your story is only useful because others have lived it and will live it again. By the time James Frey published his infamous addiction memoir, A Million Little Pieces, in 2003, addiction narratives had become so familiar, so trite, that more melodrama was required to purchase certain levels of attention. People had already heard the one about the crackhead. Now they wanted to hear the one about the crackhead who had run over a cop, spent 3 months in jail, and gone through a root canal without anesthesia. Frey's editor, Nan Talese, said she'd almost passed on his manuscript because, as one account put it, it seemed like, yes, just another addiction memoir. But she reconsidered after reading the first few pages because the grim subject matter fascinated her. When the memoir's distortions first came to light, Frey spent only one night in jail. He never hit a cop with his car. He probably did get anesthesia for that root canal. The call for reparations spread like wildfire. Oprah, who had chosen the memoir for her book club, brought Frey onto her show to stage an almost ritualistic public shaming. 12 indignant readers filed a lawsuit on behalf of indignant readers everywhere. The book had given them hope, they said, and what did that hope mean now that they knew it wasn't based on truth? A social worker who'd recommended the book to her clients filed a lawsuit seeking $10 million on their behalf. Frey's distortions became a stand-in for the truthiness of his times. His book linked to the political deceptions and overblown narratives that had justified the war in Iraq. My mistake, Frey wrote in a public apology, was writing about the person I created in my mind to help me cope and not the person who went through the experience. He acknowledged that the changed facts were lies, but insisted they were products of a story he'd told himself to get better. Frey's fabrications weren't simply a product of his imagination, however. They were a product of the marketplace. In this case, a marketplace of sentiment and trauma already swollen by inflation, an economy that demanded increasingly elaborate forms of objection to keep readers interested. I've often wanted to defend Frey, not because I find his alterations defensible, but because I find them comprehensible. Perhaps this is only because I project a certain desire onto them. Frey sought the objective correlatives of high drama. Prison time, violence, even dental work without Novocaine, because he was clutching at things that could communicate the huge stakes of how it felt to need drugs like he did. Perhaps I projected this desire onto him because I've often had it myself, this hunger for a story larger than my own, with taller buildings and sharper knives. At meetings, my stories were hardly the best ones in the room. It was like a picnic where I'd brought the plastic forks instead of the fancy brie or a key lime pie. But I also knew my presence was one small part of what allowed the meeting to happen at all, my body in a room along with everyone's. Exceptional case my ass, I was just another junkie, period. Janet tells herself in the Fantastic Lodge, describing her time at the narco farm. This disappointed me horribly, naturally. People weren't dazzled by anything I had to say or how I said it. They just listened. Yeah, I've gotten punched in the face while I was drunk too, one guy said. I wasn't supposed to tell my story because it was better than anyone else's, or worse than anyone else's, or even that different from anyone else's, but because it was the story I had. The same way you might use a nail, not because you thought it was the best nail ever made.